Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. So today is an all-opera day. I'd like to welcome right now operatic tenor Joseph Kaiser, who is singing at the Santa Fe Opera this summer. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. And that is the catchiest intro music I think I've ever heard. I wanted to get up and, like, you know,
and dance,
shake my thing. Yeah, it was great. It was really fun.
Los Mocosos.
Thank you. Yes, I'll have another.
So you are doing a couple of things. You are in Adriana Mater, and you are also in the movie version of The Magic Flute, which is opening at the Center for Contemporary Arts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's talk first about Adriana Mater. Tell us about your role. That is a very intense role, a young man who is the product of a rape.
Yeah. So the first 17 years of my life, in the context of the story, my character's name is Jonas. And I think that my father died as a war hero, and everything is fine and rosy, and my mother raised me as a single parent. And then I learn right around my 17th birthday that actually not only did he not die a war hero, but he was a rapist, and he raped my mother. And so my entire world is shattered. Everything, the whole foundation of my life, of my belief system, is torn apart. And so I confront my mother about it, and I confront her best friend, who was also a very close confidant of mine, and I set out to avenge this atrocity.
So how do you prepare for a role like that? How do you find that character and those emotions inside of yourself?
This is going to sound unbelievably unprofessional, but hear me out until you make a judgment. I don't do a ton of preparation. I learn the music, I learn my words and everything, but I really like to go in and just discover stuff in the room. And particularly if a work is in English or French, I don't do a ton of reading of my colleagues' lines because I want to hear them for the first time and because my French is good enough that I can sort of take it in and sort of have a genuine reaction in the rehearsal process. And then either through my own feedback or usually from the director's feedback, in this case we have one of the greatest directors of opera in the world, Peter Sellars, you can get, feedback that is conducive to, just very intense but very realistic drama. It's funny. The music is obviously not very readily available on recording. You can't really go out and buy it. And even if you could listen to it beforehand, out of context, it doesn't have the same effect. It's not like Mozart or Puccini where you can listen to it and it can just, transport you to another world right away. This music, Kaija Saariaho's music, it's so important to have the drama up in front of you at the same time. And then it just puts you in this world of, in this context, it's incredibly dramatic and just incredibly dense and harsh and, very deep stuff.
Yeah. Well, I suppose working with a great director, you can really put yourself in that person's hands. You don't have to come up with it all yourself.
You do, and yet, the best thing with Peter is that we're all in each other's hands. I mean, he trusts us so much and we trust him. The feedback you're going to get from him is going to be so honest and so direct. And he's just there to help all of us give the best presentation of this story and of this music as possible. If you go online on YouTube, you can watch clips of his staging of Theodora. And seriously, that should be required viewing for any undergraduate opera student. The singing is unbelievable. Don Upshaw, Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, David Daniels, Richard Croft. It's all exemplary singing, but it just all flows together so well. And you can see in those performers, in these, very famous performers, trust. You could see that they really believed in doing sometimes what appear to be weird things on stage. But it gives off this incredible emotion, this incredible feeling, and it really brings, in my mind, that piece to life in a way that it never had been. It's the same with Adriana Mater. I mean, again, it's not something that's going to sort of sing off the page. It's not something where you're going to leave the theater and say, oh, I really love that aria. That was really catchy. That's not going to happen. But what you can do is leave the theater and say, oh my God, I've never been made to feel that way in an opera or in a theater, in any sort of theatric experience. And, you know, that I think was our goal from the get-go, and Peter was incredible at helping us achieve that.
How does the singing style of this opera differ from, say, Mozart or Puccini?
It's slightly more modern. There is a bit more leeway. There is amplification, but I think that that's more for effect. So in some of the dream sequences, there'll be this eerie echo of sorts. And we also have an incredible chorus that sings in the pit. And they have, I think very rarely they actually sing actual words. They actually create a lot of sounds that just sort of either evoke a mood or represent, you know, crickets chirping at night, or really that eerie stillness and silence in, this show is chock full of awkward moments, but not awkward like, oh my God, I stepped in gum. It's like awkward as in, I'm standing next to this person and I want to kill him, but he's my father. So I don't know. Anyway, as you go about singing it, I think you still try to sing it as, you know, dramatically and accurately and beautifully at times as possible. But if there is a really harsh moment, or if there, you know, you really want to get something across with full emotion, she makes that possible too. I'll just say one thing that she does specifically. She'll have sometimes notes that have little X's through them. So you can sing them on pitch, or you can just speak them, or you can just shout them. And so that does allow for a little bit of a variance in what we're able to do.
And so that's really the discretion of the performer and the director.
Totally, totally. And we do, you know what, I do different things from show to show with those.
So. Interesting.
Yeah.
We're talking to Joseph Kaiser, operatic tenor, and you are also the star of The Magic Flute, which is a Kenneth Branagh movie opera. And it's a genre that I don't think there's that much of, namely a movie of an opera which is not shot on the Metropolitan stage. It's actually a real movie, the mm-hmm. way that, you know, Star Wars is a real movie.
I'm so glad you brought up Star Wars, because if you look at it, having been a huge Star Wars fan, not to the level of nerddom, like a Star Wars nerd, but, you know, I was into it. And, I mean, who isn't scared of Darth Vader? But there are a lot of parallels, actually, between The Magic Flute and Star Wars. But to your original point, yeah, there aren't a lot of operas that are being done in this way, and I really wish they would, because, you know, it's so great.
Is this the first one? I was just thinking the other day that I have never seen an opera that was really a movie.
Okay, there are more. There was the, I always get them confused, the son of the former Prime Minister of France. So not, the Prime Minister was François and the son is Frederick, or whichever way it is. The son directed in 1994, I think, a Butterfly. That was shot sort of on location, if you will, with Richard Troxell. And it was really good. It was really effective, too. And I know there have been others, too. And there have also been, you know, films made of Die Winterreise, actually, with, who's the singer? I can't remember. A mezzo. It's really, really cool. But no, I mean, this was a really great opportunity. You know, we were in London. We got to really jump into the score and into the story. It's obviously a story and a score that's, you know, survived without having a film made of it. But what you had here was a director, Ken Branagh, with a limited knowledge of opera, but who loved this story and loved this music and wanted to give it a fresh perspective, a really energized, vital, I don't know, he really raised the stakes. And he came up with some justifications for certain things or put things in certain contexts that I'm sure some purists will look at and say, well, come on, there was no war, Mozart didn't want a war. Well, you know, I think he puts it into a context that does make the story very relevant and very understandable. And it was produced while, you know, maintaining the integrity of the piece, it was produced for a mass audience to try and get people to give opera a try.
And by the way, the Magic Flute film opens at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe this Friday, the 1st of August at 8 in the evening. And it's the U.S. theatrical premiere of the film. So what is it like? I mean, do you sing differently? I know when stage actors act for in movies, they have to act differently. Mm-hmm. Do you sing differently?
Not at all. We recorded the soundtrack and everything that you hear in the movie that is sung. So any sung stuff we recorded, we pre-recorded at Abbey Road Studios in London.
Oh, so you're basically lip-syncing when the movie part of it is shot?
No, we're singing, but you can't hear what we're singing. So
right.
Let me explain.
Okay.
I'm singing full out when I sing like my aria in the movie, but they're just not using that recording. They're using it is canned. So they're already using something that was pre-recorded. But for it to look real, we had to sing out. So no, we're not doing an Ashley
right.
Simpson.
Right, right.
But
I suppose a lot. I mean, I was just watching The Wizard of Oz the other night. I suppose Judy Garland did that in 1939.
Yeah, I mean, it's just funny when people get so up in arms about lip syncing. Yeah, it's like when people get so up in arms about, you know, amplification in opera. I mean, I understand that I understand a bit more because the idea is that you are over an orchestra supposed to be able to support your voice in a way that it doesn't need any outside amplification. But just, you know, going back to lip syncing, I mean, one of the most famous pop moments or pop culture moments was Whitney Houston singing the national anthem at the Super Bowl during the first Iraq War. That was totally lip-synced. So, I mean, you know, it's not that the person can't sing it. It's just if you're outside and there's people cheering and, you know, I mean, okay, so maybe you need to have it pre-recorded. It's still you doing it.
And for an opera film, probably there's no way to get the sound quality.
No way. In fact, had we done it, I'm sure that all the reviews would have said, like, it doesn't sound like a recording. You know, they don't sound that good because it's echoey and because you can't control all the extraneous noise and everything. But we do have, you know, we do have some clips where you can hear what we're actually singing. So if anybody doubts that we can really sing it, I can show them those clips. I'd probably get sued, but it's worth it to me.
We're talking to Joseph Kaiser. So tell us, set up for us, without giving the whole thing away, perhaps, the story of the magic flute.
So in this context, I'm Tamino, not a prince, but rather a soldier. And there is a war. It sort of evokes the First World War feelings of and the uniforms are reminiscent of it. But again, not necessarily in any time or place. And there is a great war, and we don't really know what we're fighting for, which, you know, is very common in war. And I start it sort of as a optimistic, poetic soldier, and the whole overture sort of is 6 minutes long, and it kills any sort of optimism I might have, and my two friends are killed, and you see it happen. And by the end of the overture, I'm, you know, completely panicked and ashen faced and completely distraught. And so then, you know, more of what the normal magic flute stuff follows. Don't worry, Papageno still has birds. Papagena is still very pretty and has feathers. So all those key elements are still there.
What do you think about the mass appeal of opera? Do you think this is something that can get people who never would go to an opera in an opera house to see a movie like this?
I just think that we need to keep doing good stuff. And I realize that sounds kind of juvenile, but if we do really good, really committed, really dramatic, and really well-executed versions of opera, be it in a movie, be it on HD broadcasts, be it in a presentation for schools, be it on a regular opera stage, and we get people to come see it, that is what's going to keep this art form alive. It isn't about diluting it. It isn't about, you know, dumbing it down. I think that this art form has survived for a very long time. I think that the stories are still relevant. I think that the stories of today, so many modern movies or television shows or and such, are based on stories that operas are done with anyway. And, you know, I'm wearing, I know on radio you can't see this, but I'm wearing one of my most prized possessions, which is a La Boheme on Broadway softball shirt. The two reasons it's my most prized possession, one is because we played in a Broadway softball league. So we played against, for 6 months, we played against Phantom of the Opera, Les Mis. No, I'm serious. We played against some famous people. It was really cool. Urinetown was on at that time. This was like 2003. It was so cool. And it was a lot of fun. And, you know, like you could yell stuff at like Matthew Broderick, and it was incredible. But the other part of it that was so great was that we were on Broadway for 6 months doing a 2-hour and 15-minute opera with one intermission with entirely in Italian, and no notes had been changed. And people came and saw it for 7 months, 6.5, 7 months. I never would have believed that. But you know what? It was great singers. It was a great production. The director, Baz Luhrmann, was out of this world. And it really, really worked. Had it been a bit of a better market at that time, had there not been, you know, had it not been a difficult time for Broadway, because as the numbers go, that was a tough time, or maybe had we had a few changes in it, maybe it would have lasted a year. Maybe we could have won a Tony for Best Revival. But the point is that it was a really strong show, and people came out and they spent their money on it, and they walked away saying, you know what, that was amazing. I want to go to the opera again. So that, I think, is our responsibility. More than changing anything, more than making adjustments to you know, doing a 15-minute version of an opera or something, I think it's really important that we just really believe in what we're doing, that we show up prepared to take risks in the presentation and to give a really committed, vital, energized, and honest rendition of these pieces and perform them as if they're being done for the first time. You could do La Boheme 100 times the same way, but if you come to it and you present it as if it's being done for the first time, as if these are your best friends and this girl that you just met, that you fell in love with, is being taken away from you, and that kills you, then that's going to be interesting. You don't need to make any other adjustment to that. A 17-year-old or a 40-year-old, it doesn't matter how much opera they've seen, they'll see that and they'll know that that's important and they'll know that that's moving.
We're talking to Joseph Kaiser. So back to the Magic Flute. What was it like working with Kenneth Branagh, and what was it like working on a movie where, you know, you don't maybe don't do things in the same order and you have a really different way of you know, you don't have to do the whole performance at one time?
I'll answer this the second part of it first. I really liked doing film. I would love to do it again. I didn't mind the waiting. I didn't mind waking up early. I didn't mind the amount of weight I had to lose for it, quite frankly. I didn't mind.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I lost 60 pounds.
Heavens.
Yeah. And I didn't mind any element of it. I mean, seriously, the thing that I could see would get really frustrating would be the waiting, but I learned how to meditate. And so I would just go sit in the corner for 40 minutes or 10 minutes or an hour and a half. You never knew how long it would be. And you just chill out. Not go to sleep, but just relax, and then they'd call you, and you'd come back, and you'd be ready to go. So I loved it. I thought it was really fun, and I'd love to do it again, either for an opera or something else. As far as working with Ken is concerned, I mean, he's one of my favorite people in the world, and even if I had never worked with him on a movie, I could tell that he was one of my favorite people. When we did the sound check, when I met him backstage at Lyric Opera in 2005, I spoke with him for 10 minutes. And I thought, that's enough. Like, even if nothing else happens, I'm so happy to have met this man. He is so smart and so nice and so genuine. And then throughout, as I got further in the audition process and then when I got the job, again, every time, I was just so happy to get a chance to work with him. I'll tell you a very quick story, very fast, just to give you an idea of how he is. Part of the research for this was we had to go to the Imperial War Museum in London to do some research on World War One. They had like mock trenches there and different weapons that they would have in the trench and various things. And we went there and they started with an hour-long lecture. And we were all asking questions. And Ken was asking questions too, you know, as if he didn't know anything about it. And a couple of weeks later, I stumbled on a DVD series of World War One documentaries that he had narrated. And it turns out that he is actually a complete aficionado of the Great War. But because he didn't want any of us to feel dumb or feel like we didn't know as much about it, he was asking questions and trying to make all of us feel comfortable. And that personifies him entirely. He's all about bringing out the best performance possible from his actors. And I hope he does I hope he does an actual opera on stage one day. I know for him the biggest thing is time and having enough rehearsal time, and I definitely respect that. I don't think he would – I think he said 8 weeks he would need, and I don't think I've ever been part of an 8-week rehearsal period. But I if it was with him, I'd certainly do it. And I would do a small part. I would be the guy that, you know, sings off stage and kicks his shoes in the air, whatever.
Joseph Kaiser is in The Magic Flute, which opens this Friday, August 1st at 8 p.m. at the Center for Contemporary Arts. And he is in Adriana Mater at the Santa Fe Opera this summer. CCASantaFe.org and SantaFeOpera.org. Operatic tenor Joseph Kaiser, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. I'd like to welcome David Holloway. He is the director of the Apprentice Singers Program with the Santa Fe Opera, and Apprentice Singers Jennifer Forney and Jennifer Jacob. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
It's nice to be here.
So, first of all, let's start with you, David. Tell us about the Apprentice Program.
Well, the Apprentice Program started, actually, with the Santa Fe Opera, and the interesting thing is that it was John Crosby's idea, John Crosby being the founder of the Santa Fe Opera, and I think he was looking for a cheap way of having a chorus for his operas and decided that he would use college kids, but he couldn't get the permissions from AGMA to do that if he simply tried to do it. So he named it an apprentice program and always felt that he would have training and started the program. And it's really the first one in the country, and it may be the first one anywhere.
So it started with the exploitation of workers.
Well, I don't think he would look at it that way today. And, of course, it grew immediately into this really important program. And a number of people, of course, contributed to that. But he used at the time that they started the program in 57, he used a lot of the people that were in the – that were his artists and conductors and stage directors. And, I mean, you know, I was an apprentice myself in 1966 and 67, and my stage directors were Bliss Hebert, who was doing, you know, directing the operas at the time, and Bob Baustian, who was conducting, would come in and coach all of us. And Lotfi Mansouri was also one of our stage directors, and Lotfi went on to be director of the San Francisco Opera, Toronto Opera, and has directed all over the world. You know, all really important people were the training program of that day.
And so the training that comes out of it is I mean, serious training. They have what are the kind of training that
we have for example a number of voice teachers. Most of these people are singing a lot of choruses and doing a lot of that kind of work, which doesn't necessarily mean that keeps up their solo voices. So they need a check-in with someone who has some knowledge of that. We have diction coaches. This year we had Leo Vordoni as the Italian diction coach, and he was here about 5 weeks, and they could all work their Italian repertoire with Leo. We've had Denise Massé, who is the French coach at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. She's been here preparing the Adriana Mater and working with the apprentices all of the time on their repertoire. We've had a number of coaches, top coaches in the country, Scott Gilmore from the Chicago Opera Theater, head of music studies there, was here for 3 weeks. And we've had Diane Richardson, who coaches at the at Juilliard School, has been here. She's here about 5 weeks.
Right. So you've got good people.
I tell you, it's the best people in the world. You know, the best people you could get a hold of.
Now, Jennifer Forney and Jennifer Jacob, you've graduated from college. You're graduate students in music. When in your life do you have to decide that you're going to be an opera singer? I mean, with ballet, you have to have sort of made the decision by the time you're, you know, 10 or 11 years old. What about opera?
Well, for some, it's different than for others, because I just met a tenor who said he started singing 2 years ago.
And he's
here.
In his 20s?
Yeah, he's 24. I think it all depends, though. I started, my dad loved opera, and I started singing along when I was like 7 years old. So it's always been something I've loved to do. But I probably started really focusing on it seriously at 15.
What about you, Jennifer Jacob?
I remember my mom always telling stories that whenever we went in a car somewhere, I would just sing, no matter how long or short the trip, I would sing. So I kind of just, sang. I have a cassette where I'm 3 years old and I would sing. So I just kind of always did it. And then I started voice lessons in a smaller group in fifth grade, and then I think in eighth grade I started to get more serious about it and did solo lessons. So
once you're trained to be an opera singer, can you still – this is an incredibly naive question, but can you still sing in other styles, and do you?
Yes, maybe not so well.
I was in a funk band in high school. No one believes me, but I had a great time doing that. I've never done karaoke, but I'm dying to do it still. So I have fun doing all kinds of styles. But
I think once you have had that training to become a singer, it's hard to sing anything without exhibiting that training in some way.
Right,
so,
and thinking.
So it's a little different. And it has a little operatic cast to it. Yeah. Well, I don't find that all bad.
I mean, for example, Kerry Takanawa made a record of jazz standards with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra in the 80s.
Exactly.
And it's beautiful, but it's sort of embarrassing at the same time. It's just strange. It doesn't quite work.
It's stilted a little bit.
A little stilted.
I get accused of that by my friends that have sung musical theater. Every time I try to sing along, they make fun of me. I don't think it's that bad.
Well, so do you play other instruments as well? I mean, is that part of your training as a musician?
Well, it should be piano. I personally took piano lessons with the same teacher who taught me voice. So I kind of always got by just not practicing and saying, oh, let's sing instead. So now I regret that. Now I'm teaching and I don't have very good piano skills. So I wish I had. So I think piano is something you want to learn.
Absolutely.
A lot of us don't.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as she is. Teaching, it's nerve-wracking. You're teaching these students and you can't play their pieces, but, you know, you get by on the bass line.
So how do you take care of your instrument, your voice?
Well, you should get enough sleep. That's, like, the first thing you should be doing. You know, we're accused of always being super cautious, but I think you have to be. Just tea. I know every singer is a little obsessed with all kinds of teas. You know, just getting rest and not partying the night before you have a big performance, you know.
I mean, your instrument
sense.
Is your body.
Yeah.
And the way you treat it is the way you're going to be performing.
So it's not just your voice box. It's your whole body.
Oh, yeah.
It's really
yeah.
the whole body.
Yeah.
And I personally, I've never been terribly sensitive, you know, to winds or anything like that. But I always treat my body well, and I've rarely been ill in my singing career.
Really?
Now I don't have to worry about it anymore.
I think being at the Santa Fe Opera has made us singers more aware because of the dryness here. Everyone has a water bottle. They are just downing water like crazy, and I went to get a humidifier, and all the stores were sold out.
Because the opera's here.
Yeah,
all the humidifiers
I really think so. I really think so.
So, what's it like to sing not only in the dry weather, but also the altitude?
Oh, my God. That was a big adjustment for both myself and Jen, because when we got here, we had headaches and nausea, and there's the shortness of breath. And after about a week and a half, it was going away, and I was adjusting, but it was a change. You find that pieces you've sung before a million times were suddenly you're running out of air. So it was a big change.
It takes about 3 weeks, I think, to make the adjustment complete. And even then, you simply breathe a little bit more, and you have to discover places in your music where that allows you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I've been going to some of the New Mexico Jazz Festival, and there's people on stage playing the saxophone that look like they're going off to take oxygen. Is there oxygen backstage sometimes at the Santa Fe Opera?
I know they have had oxygen backstage, and I don't know whether it's there all the time. I suspect that it is. If somebody got into trouble, they could get the oxygen.
We're talking to David Holloway, Jennifer Jacob, and Jennifer Forney of the Santa Fe Opera Apprentice Singers Program. So what's your – when you're an opera singer, I mean – You're trained, you go to college. Do you go to college? You both went to Oberlin, is that correct?
Yes.
Which is a great music college, among other things. And you go into your studies there. Is it all music, singing, music theory? What's your training like?
For me, that's how it was. It was all – and this was something I had never really done before. I had sung, but I had never done music theory and aural skills and the piano classes – And it was a big adjustment. And once I first got there, it was kind of scary because you were just thrown into it and that was your major. And a lot of people, when they go to college, they get time to decide. And so with my experience, there was no time to really decide. It was, this is
or
what
to
you're
take,
doing.
Take astronomy. And
yeah, I mean, you could have, but I was trying to just get past those theory and oral skills classes. So that was my focus when I was there.
And so do you immediately start playing roles in major operas?
Not really. I think their policy, I mean, it's nothing official, but they like to wait at least a year or two and put you in choruses first so you've gotten some stage experience and you know how the director works. And then I personally got cast for the first time in my junior year for roles. So they kind of like to ease you in. And thinking back, you know, obviously as a freshman, you're like, oh, I want to be in the opera. But thinking back when I had my first role, I just remembered it was a really nice gradual ease into the world of opera. You know, you started with choruses, and then sophomore year you do scenes, and then you start roles. So it was a really nice way to kind of get to know how things work out.
And in a way, you're doing it all over again in the apprentice program.
Yeah.
What is the difference in how you sing in a chorus versus in a solo?
Personally, I think it's harder to check up on yourself. You kind of can get lost by hearing everybody else, and then you just sing and you don't think about, oh, am I approaching this note correctly, and am I, you know, doing everything technically? So I know for me that's an issue sometimes, but and it shouldn't be any different, but that's in theory, so I don't know.
No, I agree with you, because you can get lost among the many sopranos, and yeah, you just... It's harder to really hear yourself. And then if you're singing in a baroque chorus, sometimes you'll get conductors who want a lot of straight tone and less vibrato. And
now, straight tone is singing without vibrato.
Yes.
Can you, I mean, maybe back off the mic and give us a little demonstration of the difference between the two?
Well, this would be with vibrato, like, and this would be straight tone.
Right. And I suppose that's on any instrument. It's like that, whether it be the violin or the flute or voice.
You certainly can make those differences in most of those instruments, yeah, violin.
So you are, the two of you and many other young singers are performing on August 10th and August 17th. I think those are both Sundays. Mm-hmm. Here in the apprentice program at the opera. What are the two of you going to be doing?
I am singing Despina from Mozart's Così fan tutte, and I'm with two other girls, Sean Davis and Emily Fons, and they are playing Fiordaligi and Dorabella, and so that we are doing the top of Act Two.
And so this is scenes.
Yes.
Just
yes.
Like in college, you do scenes,
yeah.
Instead of the whole opera. What about you, Jennifer Jacobs?
I'm singing Sophie in Der Rosenkavalier by Strauss. And it's the final trio and the duet, and it is absolutely gorgeous music, and I can't wait to perform it. It's wonderful.
Now, you have just given away, by the way you said that you grew up speaking German as well as English. That must be a terrific advantage for you as an opera singer.
It really is. Well, especially in this scene, you know, it's just been really fun working with Glenn Lewis. He's our musical director for the scene, and he worked in Germany for, I believe, 8 years or
something
quite a
like
while.
That. 10 years.
Ten years. And it's just really great because he knows, you know, we will talk about, oh, I think this word, let's do the R and let's not do the, you know, it's just fun to work out details and stuff like that. So it's been great. And yeah, it's an advantage for sure.
And,
you know, I would love to talk a little about the process of how these two young women here got here. We had over in the neighborhood of 1,400 applications for this program last
year.
For
how many slots?
There are 44 slots.
Wow.
And 26 men, 18 women. And I myself heard over 800 auditions. Bob Tweeten hears a few less because I do a lot of the preliminary auditions. And we auditioned in Chicago, Indiana University, University of Kansas, Albuquerque, Los Angeles, Houston, back in Chicago, Boston, New York is where we do the most of the auditions. So the young people come from all over everywhere. I mean, we hear them from Florida or from, you know, Washington State. like Jennifer Forney, and then we weed that number down to the 44 that we're going to take.
I mean,
for the summer.
That's a tough job in itself, deciding among all these presumably many
exactly.
of them very talented people.
Exactly. But I tell you, the ones who come up are really good.
Cream rises to the top.
That's correct. And it's a terrific group this summer. And it's so wonderful to do these scenes now with them. You know, in my day, when we did scenes, John Crosby wouldn't allow anybody outside to come to the scenes. It was only people in the company. But now, last year, we had over 1,500 people to both those evenings, each evening. And I'm looking for 22, folks, 2,200. That's what I would
now,
like
it's
to
on
do.
The stage, the regular
It's on the regular stage. It's a two-hour program. Time the scenes so that and the pausa so that everything comes out to around 2 hours. It's a really wonderful evening for families. I mean, children from the age of 6 or 7 on will enjoy this evening, and you get a little bit of a taste of the mm-hmm. operas and the various pieces. The other thing we've tried to do in the programs this year is at least reflect the years that Richard Gaddis has been here, the last 7 years. So a number of the performances are from operas that he did while he was here in those 7 years.
So you've been chosen among thousands, and you know you're part of an elite group of very talented, very gifted singers and accomplished singers. It's a competitive world. How do you keep your competitive edge but also just keep the friendly and cooperative edge that you need to work with one another?
I think the competitiveness is kind of just a given, and I don't think about it. I just feel like I have to say this group has been so great because everyone is so nice, and that's kind of in the foreground for me where, you know, I don't even think about, ooh, I have to be better than this girl, and ooh, this soprano is good. You know, it's just everyone's nice, and it's great to work with everyone, so it's just a good time, you know?
If you're in an opera production, you're in with a number of other people. It's a team sport when you're doing your show. And to carry that over into the program, they're all working together in operas. It's a wonderful opportunity for them to connect with one another.
Does it feel like that connection extends to the orchestra as well?
Well, actually, recently, since we are in the pit for Adriana Mater, I have met more of the orchestra people and chatted with them, and that's actually been kind of cool because normally you don't get that experience.
So these days, which is different from when you were doing it.
Exactly. You know, back then.
Back in the olden days, you didn't have to be an actor and a dancer and a, you know, graceful person prancing across the stage the way you really do in opera now. So how do you, I mean, is that part of your... It must be part of your training now.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. I think I agree. It's been more focus has been on, you know, being a singing actor, as they say, and as opposed to just, you know, stand center stage and bellow out your aria and then you're done. And I think Oberlin reflected that. We had some really great teachers there that focused on that a lot in our opera theater classes and, you know, giving us the motivation why we're doing things and always putting meaning behind because – it is really hard in some pieces when you, in an aria specifically, you just repeat the same phrase over and over and over again and,
Kendall.
You know, trying to still create something interesting with that and not bore the audience and yourself. So,
find reasons for repeating
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So I think Oberlin was good with really focusing on that aspect as well.
Do you consider yourself actors?
I do. In my program right now, I'm at the University of Maryland, and we have to take Shakespeare class, straight acting class, opera acting class. I mean, they put so much acting on us because they think it's very important. And I think competing with television and movies and all those special effects, you really have to bring it nowadays in operas. You can't just rely on a voice.
Well, and as we talked about with Joseph Kaiser just a few minutes ago, there is actually this whole new genre where, who knows, the two of you might end up as movie star opera singers.
Well, that would be great. Well, and he was even saying, like, they made him lose 60 pounds to play that role. And I think that's another aspect of the business. You know, things are becoming much more visual. That's becoming more important, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, and of course, one wonders whether it's a good thing or bad thing, because, of course, a lot of film actors complain about, especially in Hollywood, the inordinate emphasis put on conforming to a certain kind of look, especially for women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So who are your role models as singers specifically and as performers, sort of more whole performers?
Singing-wise, I always loved Mirella Freni, and I listened to her a lot. Nowadays, I really liked Netrebko in the beginning because I thought, oh, cool, here's a lady, you know, she's spunky and, you know, she's trying to really make opera really popular, and I always think that's a good thing, and I give her credit for that. And Renee Fleming, you know, she has done amazing things artistically and is also really working hard to popularize opera more. So I respect all of that a lot, and I think that's really important.
Yeah, I'm with Jen on this one. Mirella Freni, ultimate lyric soprano. I love her. I got to pay tribute to Pavarotti. He's awesome. He always has been. I love him. But of course, Renee, I think she's fabulous. I like Patricia Rosette. There's a lot of good ones out right now. There really are.
Are these names that mean anything to you, you know?
Some of them, and maybe to some of our audiences as well. It's another world, and it's something that I wonder. I mean, it's amazing that here are all these young people, you and this whole group, who love opera. And, I mean, maybe this is something you can speak to, David. What is the audience for opera? I've read things, articles, where there's some fear that when the people who are in their 60s now are gone, there won't be an audience left.
Well, I think that that opera is something that a lot of audience people come to later, when they're through with all the drivel that is on television and out in movies, and they're looking for an art form that actually helps them to look up and beyond and a bigger arena and has more metaphorical illusions. I mean, singing is metaphorical, isn't it? It's metaphorical for speaking. That they come to opera, and I think you'll always see a mature audience that's interested in opera. And there are also people who are patient and will sit through a 3-hour or 3.5-hour performance that starts at 9 o'clock at night,
mm-hmm.
as we do here in Santa Fe.
Now, what is the career trajectory for a female opera singer? There's a certain point before which your voice isn't mature enough to take on major roles at, like, the Santa Fe Opera, for example. When do you start being of the age where you can do that, and then how many years can one sing?
That varies, of course, according to voices, because some of the lighter voices are quicker. They tend to come into
they mature earlier,
and the more lyric voices take a little more time as a rule, especially with women. But you mean all opera singers? It's wonderful how you mature through your 30s and then really become a marvelous singer in your 40s and can move on into your 50s. It's amazing.
Which is so different from dance, where most careers are over.
That's different from acting too, you know, where you almost have to be young all the time.
Well, but crazy country anyway.
But I mean, Pavarotti was at 68 and 69 still singing leading parts.
Yeah.
Would anybody like to do a little bit of singing? Jennifer Forney,
it looks like the hand
is
being gone to me.
Sure. Just about here?
Uh-huh.
Maybe a little key bell, Sonia?
That perfect.
Okay. Now, I don't have perfect pitch, so I'm just guessing here.
Sogno di Doretta pote indovinar il suo mister, come mai finì. Ahimè, un giorno uno studente in bocca la baciò, e fu quel bacio rivelazione, fu la passione. Fu l'amore
Jennifer Forney here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
David Holloway, so you have spent an awful lot of your opera career in Santa Fe one way or another.
Well, I've been around. You know, I've touched in and then gone again. I spent a whole 10 years in Europe, in which I never was in Santa Fe. Then when I came back, I came down several times, and Richard Gaddis invited me down to do a couple of winter projects here. And then in 2005, he invited me to be director of the program.
So what is it like for you not to be on stage anymore?
Well, you know what I think? I sometimes feel that all the singing that I did and all the work that I did and the study and the people that I worked with were preparing me actually for this job. You know, I've had tremendous experience. I've sung at the Metropolitan Opera. I've sung in every major opera house in this country and a number of them in Europe. And I've had a wonderful time in my career. If you Google David Holloway on YouTube, you'll hear me do the Toreador's aria. But I feel like it's, you know, I'm at a point when I'm 65 years old, and I'm at a point when I can work with young people like this. I mean, I should get out of the way. And so I'm perfectly willing to be there. And I still sing for my own amusement and fun. I go around to all the churches and hear them sing, and I sing sing all the hymns with everybody, and they all just love to have me in there in the churches. So, and I enjoy doing that.
Do you sing in church choirs?
No, I sing the hymns with everybody. You
oh,
know,
in
when,
the,
I, when I'm listening
in
to
the audience, so to speak.
Exactly.
He does.
In the congregation.
He was there last week with me.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being here. David Holloway is the director of the Apprentice Singers Program at the Santa Fe Opera. Jennifer Forney and Jennifer Jacob are apprentice singers, and we look forward to hearing from you in many years to come.
Oh, it's really nice to be here.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. Jennifer Forney, Jennifer Jacob, and many other singers from the Santa Fe Opera's Apprentice Singer Program will be performing apprentice scenes on Sundays, August 10th and August 17th. And there's reserved seats for this wonderful occasion, and they may be reserved at the Santa Fe box office by calling 986-5900, or if you're out of area, you can call 800-280-4654. And, of course, you can always go to santafeopera.org.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santaferadiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan presents a tribute to band leader and trumpet star Harry James. Broadcasting from the studios of KSFR, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao. Thank you.